chapter 5 and verse 8 and going all the way through chapter 6 and verse 9. At least that's the plan. Shane gave me a pretty large chunk of text to cover, so we will see how far we get. But let's go ahead and I'm just going to read the section from chapter 5 first, starting in Ecclesiastes chapter 5 and verse 8. If you see in a province the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, do not be amazed at the matter. For the high official is watched by a higher, and there are yet higher ones over them. But this is gain for a land in every way, a king committed to cultivated fields. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them, and what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? Sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. There is a grievous evil that I have seen under the sun. Riches were kept by their owner to his hurt, and those riches were lost in a bad venture. And he is father of a son, but he has nothing in his hand. As he came from his mother's womb, he shall go again, naked as he came, and shall take nothing for his toil that he may carry away in his hand. This also is a grievous evil. Just as he came, so shall he go. And what gain is there to him who toils for the wind? Moreover, all his days he eats in darkness and much vexation and sickness and anger. Behold, what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun, the few days of his life that God has given him. For this is his lot. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil, this is the gift of God. For he will not much remember the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart. So the first class that I taught on this apparently was very depressing, had some of you reconsidering some of your life choices. This class is also maybe going to be a little bit depressing, but there is a little nugget of hope in there that I think will keep it a little bit lighter. So let's go ahead and start off with verse 8, looking at verses 8 and 9 to start with. So a couple times in the book already, we've heard the author talk about injustice or oppression. At chapter 3 and verse 16, he talked about how we saw under the sun that in the place of justice, there was wickedness, and in the place of righteousness, there was wickedness. Or then in chapter 4, verses 1 through 3, he said, I saw all the oppressions that are done under the sun, and behold, the tears of the oppressed, and they had no one to comfort them. On the side of their oppressors, there was power, and there was no one to comfort them. And I thought the dead, who are already dead, more fortunate than the living, who are still alive. That's a pretty stark statement that he has. He has some very strong statements about injustice and the discomfort that causes us when we see it in the world. So here we have him talking about the oppression of the poor, the violation of justice and righteousness. But he says, don't be amazed whenever you see that. And we'll come back to that. But so what does Paul say the God-appointed task of government is? He kind of gives a brief summary. Does anybody remember from, I think, Romans 13? To serve justice, right? And that involves which two things? So what I'm thinking of, he says, sorry? Yeah, punishing the wicked, the wicked, and rewarding those who do good. So that's kind of the basic purpose of government. But how often is that actually the case, though? If you want to be cynical, which, I mean, those of you who know me, I am kind of a cynic sometimes. But the teacher certainly is very cynical about this. He says, whenever you see oppression and the violation of justice in the world, don't be surprised. But why? His explanation is that each official is watched by a higher official, and there are higher ones over them. So what do you think that means? It's kind of an ambiguous statement. I have my own ideas, but I'm curious to see what everybody else thinks. What do you think he means, there's a higher one over each official? Emily? Right, yeah, with so many people in the bureaucracy, I mean, people are kind of messed up, right? So it's very likely that at some point the bureaucracy or system or whatever is going to be messed up or broken. Any other thoughts on that? Yeah, everybody is accountable in some way. You know, it's if you talk to a low-level official, well, they have a boss, and that boss has a boss, and that boss has a boss. Even if you get, in our society, you go all the way up to the president, even the president technically is accountable to the people, right? Although they may not have, that may not be a boss relationship. But I think another possibility that it's talking about is that people in power tend to look out for each other, right? I scratch your back, you scratch mine. That might be what's going on. If you look the other way in this and let me get a little extra on the side, then I'll do the same for you. Does that make sense? And how often do we see that in the world, right? It's everywhere. And another option, like we were talking about, is that if there's a problem that you want fixed, you just have to keep going up the chain, right? Like if there's something wrong with whatever is going on, if there's an injustice and you want it fixed, you can't always talk to the first person, right? They got to talk to their boss, and that boss has to talk to their boss all the way on up. You actually see a little bit of that, I think, in Jesus' trial, right? Where he first he's on trial by the Jews, and then he has to go to Pilate, and then Pilate sends him to Herod, then he goes back to Pilate, right? There's a little bit of this bureaucracy where in it, eventually, of course, what happens? Justice is not served. The one who is innocent is the one who's put to death. But I think ultimately the way I look at this is that kind of like Emily was saying, the problems of selfishness and injustice that all of us have within ourselves to some extent, they become very, very easily baked into the different systems, your bureaucracy, your government, or whatever you want to call it, that we set up. The way that our societies work, because it's made up of broken individuals, the societies themselves are broken. And so it's not surprising then when people who are selfish and broken end up doing things that are unjust. So then what about verse 9? There's a couple, there's a lot of different translations. So I read from the ESV, which says, but this is gain for a land in every way, a king committed to cultivated fields. Does anybody have a different translation of verse 9? And would they like to share that translation? Yeah?
The New Living mm-hmm. says, even the king milks the land for his own profit.
Okay, even the king milks the land for his own profit. So that's a little bit more cynical. Anybody else? I know we have more than just two translations in here. Yeah, in the back?
Moreover, the profit of the earth is for all. The king himself is served by the field.
Okay, the profit of the earth is for all, and the king himself is served by the field. Okay. Anybody else? All right, so we got three translations in here tonight. Very nice. Luckily for you guys, I went ahead and looked at a bunch of different translations. So I don't know if you guys can actually read all of those. But basically, there's two different ways that you can look at this verse. You could either view it as having a positive evaluation of the king, which is reflected in the ESV, which is what I read, or even the NASB. After all, a king who cultivates the field is an advantage to the land, right? So you read that and you think, oh, king is good, right? Because the king helps the land produce food by, you know, keeping everybody safe and whatnot. But then there's some more negative evaluations of the king. The NIV says, the increase from the land is taken by all. The king himself profits from the fields. We already read the New Living Translation. The NET Bible says, the produce of the land is seized by all of them. Even the king is served by the fields. So there's a lot of variance in the translations. So I'm just kind of curious, how many people lean more towards the positive evaluation? How many people lean more towards the negative? Okay, I think I saw a few more towards the negative. Personally, that's what I would lean to myself. If I were, you know, just just reading it, again, like I said, I can be a cynic sometimes. This is definitely a case where that's true. But I think it might be a little bit of both. If you can read down there at the bottom, I found a translation that said Young's literal translation. I've never used it, but it seemed, from what I understand, it seemed like it did a pretty good job of capturing kind of the ambiguity of this phrase. It says, "The abundance of a land is for all. A king for a field is served." If you're like me, you read that and you're like, okay, a king for a field is served. What? Who talks like that, right? What's going on here? So I think maybe what it's trying to get at is that the king is supposed to protect the land and administer a government that allows people to benefit from cultivated fields, right? That's what the king is supposed to be. But even in the Old Testament, how often is that the case? And in fact, if you think about it, how often is it the case that the king actually ends up taking land from the people, like in the case of Ahab and Naboth? Or how often is it the case that the king takes other things that belong to the people? So I think maybe this verse, it is ambiguous, so I'm gonna go with the old Shane cop-out and say that it's both. It is it's kind of hinting at both sides of the coin, that there is a there's an ideal version, but that unfortunately is not the reality. Yes.
I don't know what the original would have said. You said that other translation that you've got is a literal, and so it doesn't necessarily indicate the context that the ESV and the New American Standard does, that starts that verse with "but." Mm-hmm. So if the original would have indicated the contrast, then it's almost presented like the Proverbs. You've got this, but this, and often that's a negative, but the positive, or vice versa. And that's why I take it as a positive. Here's the negative. You've got the violations, you've got transgressions, mm-hmm. but a king who is committed to cultivating the land, he's helping his people. Everybody in every way is served. And that's like the opposite of the violation. So I guess that's the positive way, but I don't know if the contrast is presented really.
Yeah, I don't know anything about Hebrew, really. The best I can do is just look at what all the translations say. So that is an interesting point. It is set up in the ESV, at least, with a contrast. So it's possible that there's a word there, a conjunction that could mean and or but. I know there are words like that in Greek. So it could be one of those ambiguities. Did I see a hand up back there? Yeah. Right, yeah. I don't think he's trying to say that, all kings are always bad, or all government is always bad. But I think he's just, like we've seen, he's just observing what he sees about the world. And, certainly I think there are times when having a king who, like Ed said, is actually committed to cultivated fields, which you could use as shorthand for benefiting the people that he rules. Having a king like that would certainly be a good thing. But I think there's also just the reality that we see that I think most of the time, again, call me a cynic, but I think the people in power tend to look out for themselves. Yeah, John?
To me, it seems like, and I think I understand what they're saying, but to me, it's building on the hierarchical relationship of governments.
Mm-hmm.
In verse 8, he's talking about the officials who watch over the officials. There's a scaffold. But it doesn't go higher than the king. And
yeah.
He's saying, even after all, even the, now the king does not cultivate the land himself.
Mm-hmm.
The king has his servants. He has the common people do it. And it seems that even based on this hierarchy, even the king uses that to his advantage. He taxes. And you know, Solomon, but Rehoboam was in that dilemma of
mm-hmm.
how to tax. And he burdened the people even greater than his father had. And it's just, it makes me think of that kind of scenario,
yeah.
Especially coming off of verse 8, where he's talking about the corruption of what I believe the officials of government.
Yeah, that's a great point. So I think this whole discussion about, you know, corruption in government, the fact that a lot of times everybody is kind of looking out for themselves, at least a little bit, it leads right into the next section, verses 10 through 17. In verses 8 and 9, he's kind of talking about the outer effects of wealth and power, what it does to the society, maybe. But in the next eight verses, I guess, he looks at what it does to you on the inside, what the love of money does to you on the inside. And he starts off in verse 10 making a simple but powerful observation. If you love money, you will never be satisfied with it. And he also adds, as your wealth increases, it becomes more and more difficult to manage that wealth. I think that's what he's saying in verse 11. He says, when goods increase, they increase who eat them. The more money you have, the more people there are that want a little bit of that. They want you to help them out or whatever. You always hear stories about people who win the lottery and then hear from relatives that they haven't heard from in 15 years, right? That kind of thing. And really, the only benefit, he says, that you get from chasing after more and more wealth is you get to look at it, right? You get to look at your big piles of gold. And I guess for us, we just see bigger numbers on our bank statements or whatever. This is a bit of an exaggeration, right, in terms of the benefit of money. Because, I mean, who here, like, the only thing that we do with our money is just stare at it in our bank account? Yeah, nobody. We buy stuff with it. We buy food. We buy housing, stuff like that. But I think there is an element of truth to what he's saying, if you think about it. Recently, when I was just scrolling through Facebook or whatever, an interview with Shaquille O'Neal popped up. And I don't know, I'm not a big basketball person. I don't know why Shaquille O'Neal was in my Facebook feed. But it was an interview where he was talking about his house. And his house, it's like 30,000 square feet. And he was saying, yeah, I only use three rooms in my house, the bedroom, the kitchen, and the TV room. He says that's all he uses his house for. And it's like, so what good is that house to him now? He has 30,000 square feet, and he uses a few hundred of them. I think of, you know, when I was a kid, I loved Lego sets, especially Lego Star Wars sets. And, you know, every time I got one, I'd be so excited to build it. But then when I was done, it was like, well, there it is. I mean, maybe I go zoom, zoom, zoom with it. But, like, I mean, that's about it, right? It didn't really change the way that my life was. It didn't, you know, 5 days later, you know, I'm thinking of another Lego Star Wars set that I wanted. And I think we might talk about this in greater detail later in the quarter, depending on how much time we have at the end. But I think this is a really powerful point, especially in our culture, because our country is obsessed with wealth. We have newspapers and websites and experts that are all dedicated to telling you what's going on with the economy, what's going on with the stock market. We have lists of the wealthiest people in the world that lots of people like to browse through. We pay money to people so that they can tell us how to save money or make more money or whatever. Shane mentioned, I think it was on Sunday, that our culture worships sex. Well, I think we also worship money. And just like the world is trying to get us to buy into lies about sex, it's also trying to get us to buy into its lies about money. And way too often, at least this is my experience, I think we believe those lies, at least a little bit, right? I mean, how many times have you thought, you know, if I just made a little bit more money, or if my job just paid a little more, if I saved a little bit more each month, if inflation wasn't so high, you know, then I'd finally be able to buy a new house or go on that fancy vacation or retire earlier or whatever. Insert your financial goals here. And if I could do that, then I would be satisfied. I'd be happy. I would finally have made it. Those are lies that the world is telling us about money. And these verses contain such a simple observation. Money doesn't satisfy you. And if you just sit with it, it cuts through all of those lies about wealth and money that we hear. If you love money, you will not be satisfied with money. And I think ultimately, it's not just about being wealthy or having money, because you can love money and be dirt poor. It's about what we chase after. If we chase after money, Kohelet says, it's vapor, it's vanity, it's going to disappear right in front of us. And he says in verse 12, look at who sleeps better at night. The laborer sleeps well, even if he goes to bed hungry, because he's so tired from his day's work, right? But the rich man's stomach is so full that it keeps him up at night. It's like he has indigestion, he's eaten so much. And then, to illustrate the dangers of loving money, he tells this story in verses 13 through 17. He says, there's this wealthy guy who lost his money in a bad venture. An investment went south or something like that. And this guy, he had a son. But now he doesn't have anything to give to his son. He didn't have anything that he could pass on as an inheritance. And so the teacher says, this guy, he had all of this wealth, but he ends up with the same thing that he entered this world with. Nothing. He's not even able to pass down anything to his son. And in verse 16, he asks the question that he started the book with, that Kohelet does. He says, what gain is there to him who toils for the wind? So let me kind of break down what I think is happening in these verses. Maybe after hearing that first bit about wealth and money, we think to ourselves, well, you know, maybe I won't get more and more money for me, but, you know, if I earn a bit more or save a bit more, then I'll have enough and I'll pass it down to my kids, or I'll give it to other people or whatever. And maybe that seems to be maybe what he's getting at here, I think. But again, he doesn't control money. His investment goes south and he loses it all. What good does that do for him in the end? And so I think what the teacher is saying is that wealth is vain for two reasons. Number one, it doesn't satisfy you. And number two, it's unpredictable. We don't know what's going to happen to the stock market or the housing market or whatever you're putting your financial hopes in. And the teacher says, if you spend your whole life trying to save up money to give to your kids and then you lose it, what gain has your life been? What gain is there? And notice what he says in verse 17. What did this guy have to do in order to amass great wealth? What does it say? Yeah, he eats in darkness, in much vexation, and sickness, and anger. Shane has mentioned this before. It's like Ebenezer Scrooge. Like, all he's focused on is just saving, 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 and he just has this miserable life. It said back in verse 13 that this guy, he had kept his great wealth to his own hurt. So this guy, he has made himself miserable his whole life so that he can build up this vast amount of wealth. And then he loses it, just like that. All of that misery was for nothing. So like I was saying earlier, our country worships money. And sometimes that worship is expressed through excess displays of wealth or greed. But I think also sometimes that worship is expressed through extreme stinginess. I mean, how many people are willing to make themselves miserable if it means they make more money or they save more money? How many people work at jobs they hate or with people they hate because it pays well? How many people work ridiculous hours or move halfway across the world because they get to retire early or something like that? And the question to ask is, why do we make ourselves so miserable for something that doesn't last and something that we can't control, something that doesn't satisfy us? And I'll be honest, this is something that I've kind of been grappling with over the last couple years as I've entered the workforce and started to make a consistent paycheck. I mean, do I do whatever I can to max out my potential earnings and maybe retire early or have a nicer house or whatever? Or, you know, do I want to have a job that I like, or do I value location? There are all sorts of questions that that we have to answer. And money is, or the world is trying to get us to think through the lens of just money. How much stuff can I have? What's my net worth going to be if I do this versus this? And the teacher says, that's just smoke. That's vapor. That's vanity, just chasing after the wind. And he says, ultimately, this is a grievous evil, he says in verse 16. This is not the way to live. This is not a good life. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great point. A lot of times, wealth is not—it's not just your bank account. It's also the stuff that you have. And I think that's, you know, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus talks about you can't serve God and mammon. And as I understand, mammon is not just like cash. It's also stuff. It's your possessions. So I think that's a reality as well that we have to be aware of. Yeah, Dean.
Like you're
Yeah, I think what you were saying about, you know, the problems of wealth, is that's kind of what he was getting at in verse 11. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. You know, the more stuff you have, the more people want some of that stuff, the more problems accompany it. And so the lie, I guess I should be clear, the lie is not that, you know, money is going to ruin your life and so we should all try and be dirt poor. That will make your life miserable. The lie is that money will satisfy you. Money is the answer to all your problems. It's not. It's the answer to many problems, but not all of them. Yeah, Mr. Dave.
To me, it's where you put your thought and effort. If it's strictly to make more money, mm-hmm. that's valuable. There's not anything wrong to have money. I'm just poor if I have money. But I'd much rather have a little money.
Absolutely. It's all about what we chase after, right? If we're chasing after wealth, like he says, it's vanity. All right. So the teacher looks at this way of living, and he says, this is not the way to live. This is a grievous evil. But then he suggests a better way to live in verses 18 through 20 of chapter 5. This is another one of our Carpe Diem passages, seize the day. And notice in these passages, these verses, we already read, so I won't read them again, but how many times does God appear in these verses? Somebody do a quick count for me. Three? I counted four. Does anybody have more than four? Okay. I mean, maybe it's different translations. I don't know. And in the previous verses, I don't know if you're making a note of this as we read, but in the previous verses, how many times was God mentioned? Zero. So, I mean, this is kind of a simple analysis, but I think there is something to be said for this. I think the implication is that if you want to find a good way to live, a better way to live, you got to acknowledge God. You have to look at God as the giver of good things. And that's actually really all it says about God here. Three times it says God gives, or God has given. Or in the end he says God keeps this man occupied with joy in his heart. And so to kind of summarize what I think the teacher is recommending in these verses, it's an attitude of acceptance rather than one of grasping. Rather than chasing after wealth or trying to hold on to things that are beyond our control, he wants us to just accept what we have. He says if it's fitting to eat and drink and find enjoyment in the things that God has given you. Rather than chasing after wealth, we should just accept it. Because is wealth going to satisfy us? No. But God can. And is wealth something that we can trust in? No. But God is someone that we can trust in. And so the teacher says, if you have food or drink or money or possessions, just thank God for it and accept it. And if you do that, he says in verse 20, you won't remember the days of your life because God will give you joy. And that sounds kind of weird to us. We're like, wait, I'm in like a drunken stupor because I'm so full of joy. What's going on? But I think it's intended to contrast with the man who eats in darkness and vexation. There's these two pictures. It's one person who is so in the moment, so full of joy and happiness and thankfulness that they don't even notice the time passing. Versus this other person who is alone and who is just constantly brooding and upset and trying to grasp as much as he can from this life. I think that's what's going on here. It's these two different options that we have. Yes.
Somebody else, bad things happen, that's the way life under the sun through enjoying things that God's given, understanding where they come from.
Yeah, that's a great point. These two pictures, from an exterior perspective, just looking at, you know, what they have, they probably look very similar, right? You might have two people that are both very well off. They have a lot of things that they get to enjoy, but one person is filled with contentment and joy, and one person is constantly wanting more. I think that's the point. Yeah, Dean?
To piggyback on what Tom said, if we look at everything we have as a gift, then if it happens to go away, we're still content. You know, whatever mm-hmm. God has for us, right, it's physical wealth, or it could be even our physical abilities, everything can be added in that category. And if we're able to look at everything that we have, our being, our breath, as a gift that we don't deserve, then if we lose it, or if we happen to experience different things in this life, then we look at it from that standpoint, rather than me, 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 I earned this, and then when we lose it, I lost it. And that's where the evil and Satan creeps into our lives. But it's a hard perspective to have, to be easy to say out loud, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that is the perspective that John's pointing out here in the verse, and just following up on it. That's the perspective that's striving for us.
Yeah, it's easy to talk about that perspective and describe it, but it's very hard to put into practice. As I was going through, I was thinking, like, man, I mean, I'm not really frequently consumed by darkness and vexation and all that. I don't think so, at least. But at the same time, I don't think I would be characterized as the second person here. I don't think you would. I don't think I recognize the things in my life as gifts from God. At least not often enough. So, you know, maybe we're not as bad as this one guy that the teacher tells us about, but we probably have a lot of room for improvement in the way we're living. Yeah, Jackson?
I might get a little weird for a second here, but
okay.
It's hard for me to read this, especially this book, but also this chapter, and not see that even Q could see that there is privilege, even as far back as in the Old Testament. And I think you are kidding yourself if you do not think that there is privilege today, and that all of us in this country are extremely privileged. And rather than focusing on the things that we have and the luxuries as blessings from God, sometimes we have to recognize that we are privileged. And the blessings that we have from God are the things that Hugh talks about finding fulfillment and enjoyment in, which are our families and our relationships and the joy that comes from serving God. Those are the blessings that we truly can be thankful for and focus on, because those things can't distract us from God. They draw us nearer to God. The other things that we experience that have to do with privilege, while they certainly may be in some way a blessing, we have to recognize that they're just things. They are just part of stuff in this life. And what we really have is what Hugh tells us to enjoy, and that is God. That's the relationships that come from loving God and from the family that he's given to us, and finding a spouse and finding fulfillment in the work that you can do. That's something that all of us can enjoy.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. There is, I think, a fine line between talking about privilege versus blessings. I do think that he doesn't really get into it here, but I think that later in the book, and then especially in the New Testament, we see the Bible talk about how, you know, if you are given wealth, whether that be through privilege or blessing, you have a responsibility to use that wealth to bless other people. I think we see that, in chapter 11 is where I see that in Ecclesiastes, which obviously we'll get to way down the road. And then especially in the teachings of Jesus, who taught radical generosity. So that's not really present in this passage, but I absolutely agree. The gift of wealth is not something that we just hold on to and we sit on. It's something that we give out. The blessings that we do just soak in the moment, I think, especially are the things that you mentioned, like family, friends, the pleasures of this life, like food and drink. So I think that's a great point. So let's see, we only have 2 minutes left, so I don't think we're going to get through the first part of chapter 6. So I just want to close. Let me see if I can skip ahead in my notes here. So when Dean and I were first teaching Ecclesiastes to the college class earlier this year, this whole idea of just like accepting and being grateful for the present moment, it was something that really challenged me. I thought at first, like, of course I'm enjoying the good things in life, right? Like, I mean, aren't we all? Like, I enjoy a good hamburger or a steak or whatever. I enjoy time with friends and family. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized, am I really being intentional about soaking these things in? Am I really being grateful for the good things that I enjoy? And am I giving thanks to God for them? And I realized that I really was not. I did not necessarily have that mindset. So this is it's a very uplifting message, I think, compared to what we've been studying. But it's also incredibly challenging, because living this way requires just a great amount of intent and purpose and consciousness in the present moment. It's something that I've been trying to practice, but I found it to be really, really hard, because we just get so caught up in the future or whatever we're chasing that we don't fully appreciate the good meals or the time we spend with loved ones or just the nice weather. It's so easy to miss all of that and not to live in the present out of thankfulness to God. So I hope that's one lesson that you can take away from this class. I know the previous one I taught was a bit of a downer, but this one, as it turns out, is ending on a much more hopeful note. So I really encourage you, live with intent and joy in the present.